What if I told you that queer people have always had altars? That we've prayed in clubs and in churches, in bedrooms and on dance floors, with candlelight, glitter, silence, and sound. We've always had saints and deities. And when we were kept from them, we became our own. I'm Hannah Beattie, the producer and host of this episode of Unboxing Queer History. And today, we're talking spirituality, religion, queer people, life's big questions, and what the archives of our queer spiritual ancestors may have to teach us.
Welcome to Unboxing Queer History, a podcast from Gerber Hart Library and Archives. Gerber Hart is an independent nonprofit library and archives with collections that focus on the LGBTQ plus history of Chicago and the Midwest. This season was made possible by Broadening Narratives Grant from the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation and by support from listeners like you. Thank you. Today, we hear from Hannah Feedy about the many forms of queer spirituality in history and today.
Growing up Catholic, I felt like my power as a woman and later my sexuality were always in conflict with the religion I was raised in. For years, I denounced my connection to faith, not because I didn't feel spirit, because I was taught that my proud, queer, feminist identity couldn't live alongside religion. And still, spirit kept finding me through song and vibration, on dance floors, in the water at Hollywood Beach. Joining the gospel choir in college reignited my spark. And later, becoming a DJ took me deeper. Today, I want to take you with me into a living, breathing archive of queer spirituality. We'll begin where I began, at the Gerber Hart Library and Archives in Chicago. I went looking for traces of queer spiritual life in the stacks. And to my surprise, there were actually several collections across many different faiths. I was deeply moved, and not just by what was preserved, but by what it pushed back against. There were boxes of materials, personal and community archives that challenged a belief I quietly carried for years, that queerness and religion were inherently at odds. But now, I had in front of me a pamphlet dated 1984 from a local Lutherans Concern chapter organizing for gay inclusion in the Evangelical Lutheran Church, a handbound Or Harash prayer book from one of the first gay and lesbian Jewish congregations in the country, founded in Chicago in 1976. The prayer book was filled with tender footnotes from a community that dared to worship using gender-expansive language. The autumn edition of the Radical Fairy Digest from 1974, a rural, earth-based, queer spiritual newsletter whose name kept changing. Rural Free Delivery, Raunchy Fairy Dreams, code-switching in plain sight to preserve a world of our own. I was definitely inspired, but honestly, from a podcast producer's standpoint, I was overwhelmed. How could I possibly respond to all of this material, all this proof, this evidence? How could one episode hold the fullness of all these sacred remains, all of this queer spiritual life? Where should I go from here? So I took a broad approach, because as much queer life as the archives reflected, I was convinced just as much might be missing, yet to be recorded. What might we learn from adding to the archive? And how might it feel to listen? In my exploration of queer spirituality, I called clergy and posted on my socials, asked friends to ask their friends to see if anyone might want to speak with me. I was especially curious about the groups represented in the archives. In this episode, you'll hear from 9 different voices, 9 different queer people who've questioned, built, inherited, and redefined spiritual life in ways that speak to who they are. These stories deserve to be remembered, and I hope that somewhere in them, you find something that stays with you, that touches you. Turns out, I didn't have to look as far as I thought, which might be a metaphor in and of itself. Our first voice comes from within Gerber Heart.
I'm Sharon Levy. I've been volunteering with Gerber Heart since 2023, and I am also a Jewish archivist. I started volunteering at Gerber Heart in 2023. I was still really new to Chicago. I have grown a lot as an archivist, but I keep coming back to volunteer because I really enjoy the breadth of the collections that I get to work with. I get to do my own research, but also the mission is extremely important. One of the largest collections I've worked with thus far at Gerber Heart is Congregation Or Hadash. Or Hadash was a Jewish synagogue that existed in Chicago from the 1970s through 2016, and they catered specifically to queer Jews in a time where it wasn't super welcome in more traditional religious communities. I have always felt mostly welcome being LGBT in the Jewish community, but to be able to work with a collection that specifically is about the queer community in the Midwest and how they grew from being fringe to being fully accepted members of the community was really exciting. In the Or Hadash collection, they have the really large Or Hadash flag that they marched with in Pride for many years. Lots of photographs, stickers, and merchandise that they made to hand out. There are a lot of prayer books, especially really significant ones that include prayers with new translations that spoke to the Or Hadash community. There was so much time spent reworking the prayer book, and that's why I spent so much time researching it, because I think it's really significant that you can say, hey, we have all of these prayers that have been said for the last 2,000 years by almost every Jew and the same melodies, but what if we change the translation? How does that make it more relevant to us without changing the history of that prayer? Or Hadash closed as an independent institution in 2016. And at that time, a number of former board members from Or Hadash together brought in all of the boxes that consisted of 40 years of history, and they donated it to Gerber Heart. There was a man named Norman Sanfield who was extremely influential in both the Jewish community and the LGBT community in Chicago for many, many years. He was involved in Or Hadash, and I believe he was one of the people who is the impetus to bring all of the history of Or Hadash to Gerber Heart. He recently passed away, very sad and of loss to the community, but in his life, he did so much work, including saving all of this history for us to have today. Gerber Heart is really important in that it's not reliant on current or future or past political statements or stances from anyone in the government. A non-government nonprofit, all of the money we get is given to us freely from people who care about the mission. We are not bound by any restrictions that are put on libraries or museums, and we can continue collecting and preserving history the way we think it should be preserved. And that also means that we can be a space for the queer community, open houses for events and play readings and zine drawing workshops. A lot of community space can be filtered through Gerber Heart without an expectation of following some overarching rules that may or may not apply to us.
Mm-hmm. My name is Michael Fick, and I am the pastor here at Ebenezer Lutheran Church in Andersonville, and I use pronouns like he and him. I've been in this position as the solo pastor here for 13 years. I kept trying to do other things and kept being pulled back. Fine, I will go to seminary and it won't work out. That was 20 years ago. At the time, even the more progressive denomination that I'm in did not have a policy to allow queer folks to serve openly. And if they did, they had to be celibate. The enforcement of that depended on where you were and who your bishop was and kind of don't ask, don't tell kind of places. I came here in 2011 and was able to be completely open from the jump. I had to come out to my religious community as gay, and then I had to come out to the gay community as clergy. Both of those had bumps, and understandably so. I never take personally, you know, if someone pushes back on my vocation, and because it's not about me, it's about their experience, and I know that. But when I'm in like very queer spaces, I have checked myself on like, well, maybe I just don't bring up what I do. And I've been trying to not do that. I was the benefit of my spiritual ancestors, the queer folks that did a lot of the heavy lifting before me. Me being here is what that accomplished. If I can speak to them in gratitude, I'm glad to do that. An organization called Lutherans Concerned emerged and had a focus on advocating for full equality for queer folks in congregations. A big piece of the work was advocacy work at the congregational level. Like maybe you can't turn the ship of the denomination, but you can start turning the hearts of folks in pockets, in smaller groups. So what started happening alongside this Lutheran Concerned movement, ordaining queer folks that had not been approved and calling them to be their ministers, even though that was not allowed. This move to start ordaining people who were otherwise completely qualified. This was not a matter of ordaining people that didn't have a seminary degree. They just happened to be queer. That's the story of how things emerged in this denomination. A member of this church who unfortunately now suffers from pretty severe dementia, but I want his name out there. His name is Ralph Conrad. And he was a pastor in a specifically queer denomination that emerged in the 70s called the Metropolitan Community Churches. And he was the pastor of Good Shepherd Metropolitan Community Church here in Chicago, which is no longer open. That denomination was really hyper-focused on meeting the spiritual needs of queer people. That was their whole reason for existence. When I was helping him clean out his condo to move to memory care, has an absolutely beautiful black leather stole, what ministers wear. He actually used to do church services on Sunday mornings at IML. Which is really delightful. It also shows that people move through the world both spiritually and queer. Some have found that they can't do that in Christianity or they don't want to. And I have nothing but respect for that because people have to deal with their trauma in the way that it is healthy for them to do so. You know, there are a lot of folks, I think, that are curious about how these two things can exist in the same space. So that's what Lutherans Concerned was all about, was trying to provide spaces and places for Lutherans in particular to continue their spiritual practice and not feel like they had to leave it behind. I'm not surprised you have boxes of detailed documentation. And frankly, that's why this went from incredibly controversial to me sitting here with you in 30, 40 years, which in the grand scheme of things is not a long time. I have to remind myself that things have changed extraordinarily over the course of just even my lifetime. I would guess about a third of this congregation identifies as queer. And I know for sure that the rest of it would identify as allies. Couples with children chose to come to this kind of church because they wanted their children to know that you can have this kind of religious and spiritual life without excluding anybody. We try very hard to be gender inclusive. Particularly, we use a variety of names, biblical, by the way. Father's not the only word for God. Author of creation is my current favorite. And that's biblical. It's less about inventing new language, but recovering language we've always had with us that we didn't choose to center. Pulling random verses from different parts of the Bible that have absolutely no context to say what you already wanted to say is an abuse of scripture. Scripture always has historical context. It always has cultural context. There are pieces of Scripture that simply do not apply to our current culture and context. They just don't. You are literally and metaphorically translating something from a different language in a different culture in over thousands of years. That's something that has to be done communally. I don't think any one person gets to decide what all of that means. Part of my spiritual journey is to find out that I didn't know something, that I didn't understand something, what Scripture would describe as receiving a new insight. As a pastor, that's always the danger, to meet somebody and be like, oh, I know what they need. No, you don't. Deep listening invites me to keep being surprised by people in a good way and to learn that there's more out there than I can perceive and understand. If God is just everything I am, that's not it. And if I ever feel like I have arrived spiritually, like I've got it figured out, then I need to not be doing this anymore. That level of absolute certainty about everything, number one, it hurts people. And number two, it's just incurious. It's to say there's nothing new. There's nothing emerging. There's nothing more. Manifesting things is queer work. And I think that's true in a religious context, too.
My name is Jackie. I use they, them pronouns. My relationship to spirituality right now is focused on the Druid folk magic side. Also still identify as Christian and keep plugged into that community. I grew up in Southern West Virginia, evangelical Christian household, backwoods Methodist church. That was really like where neighbors came together to be in community. We all live at least a mile from each other. Even as a kid, I experienced some cognitive dissonance between what I felt Christianity was and like what my connection to God versus the messages I was receiving from the church. Oh, love the sinner, but hate the sin. That just didn't make sense. My mom or grandmother saying, oh, you have to be submissive to a man and that's how you achieve salvation. But they were really strong female role models that weren't submissive to men. I didn't really question it though until I got to college. I was participating in a campus Christian group. The messages about gender and sexuality, I was like, I don't vibe with this. And it's kind of like that same messaging. And I maybe felt betrayed a little bit. I studied abroad in my undergrad in Japan. I was hiking and going to a lot of temples and shrines. In Western words, it's Shintoism, but it's like paganism on those pilgrimage paths and at the shrines and temples. Noticed in my body that same feeling I felt in church and community when we're singing and dancing. Okay, well, maybe there is something. I don't need to completely denounce spirituality, questioning at that point. My friend gifted me my first tarot deck, and then I got super obsessed with it. That was the spark of exploring Appalachian granny magic and folk magic, the superstitions I grew up with. Appalachian granny magic is this really unique blend of cultures, particularly in coal towns, literally a company town, and everybody's working for the company. They shop at the company store with their company dollars. It's a very closed off community. People working in coal mines were not people that came from privilege. Indigenous peoples that were colonized there. West Virginia broke off from Virginia during the Civil War. So a lot of freed slaves or people fleeing were going to West Virginia, working in the coal mines. And then a lot of immigrants from Ireland, Scots-Irish. So those three marginalized people coming together, sharing their practices, created this really unique blend, Appalachian granny magic. It has some elements of hoodoo or root work, elements of Celtic paganism. The indigenous parts are more lost in history. There's some documentation, but it's still an active process to recover those things because of white supremacy. The way I found church again was pretty organic. At the advice of a practitioner that was like, as a child, that was your very first connection point to a higher spirit. Even if it's not something you identify with anymore, and that stuck with me, I was like, let me seek this out again. One of our preachers is an abolitionist, and it was just like, yeah, this is great. More than that, it was seeing older people feel that way, stepping into a space where the message wasn't love the sinner, hate the sin. It was more like, I don't decide what sin is or isn't, because that's not my place. My place is to like show up for you, to just love you as a neighbor, to be there for you. That was a really core part of getting through that period of my life. If you're struggling with that, the feelings you're feeling are real. Let yourself grieve. They're not by mistake. It's by a system that has fed us information to enforce power and control. You're not supposed to be existing within that system. So feel all the feelings that you need to feel. Your community will find you, but don't force yourself if you're not ready.
I'm Saint, they, them pronouns. I guess I would identify as spiritual over religious, but I am still a Greek Orthodox Christian, knowing at a very young age that I was neither boy nor girl was really difficult. I didn't have words, and no one in my very tight-knit Greek community would talk about it. There were whispers of a cousin Stephen. He was so bad. How hard it was on my aunt when he died during the AIDS epidemic. I actually have this little ladybug here on my arm in honor of him. Growing up, that was spoken about without any context. There were so many men like that in the Greek community. I had these obscured examples of queerness still being allowed in the space, but it was a certain palatable queerness. Whereas if you went outside of that, there was no room. You were an abomination. So much so that my peer's mom called my mom to tell her that I was queer. And that was it. So I got outed. I'm so grateful that it happened, because I don't think that I would be living life as openly and unabashedly if I hadn't gone through the trauma of getting kicked out of my house that night and for like a couple weeks. My mom slapped me because she didn't want me to go to hell. Like, she had all of this fear, all of this anxiety, all of this resentment based in this religious trauma that she grew up with. Having like adults try to push me out of the church because I wasn't supposed to be there. I shouldn't take communion. You shouldn't do this. You shouldn't do that. Is really hard. I grew up literally doing soup kitchens every week. We have cousins who are coming over from Greece. They need a job. They need clothes. They need a place to live. Like, we are creating this safe, beautiful space, and yet we can't be queer. That made it really shameful and really difficult. I recently went back to the church that I grew up in for our Greek festival, and I might start crying talking about it. Everyone that I grew up with was back, and there were so many queer kids who were so involved in church and so involved in the community. And all of the adults, our youth group leaders, came up to me and were giving me huge hugs, and they were so happy that I was there. Everybody thanked me for staying in church. And a couple of them even apologized for not understanding 20 years ago. There's so much growth that can happen if you don't let other people kick you out of the space that you know you belong in. To be on the receiving end of an apology in my 30s, like 20 years after this happened, was so healing. You know, anybody can change if they want to. The Orthodox Church quite literally hasn't changed in over 2,000 years in terms of what rituals are given. What's really beautiful about Orthodoxy in terms of Christianity is that it still touches so much of the Jewish faith, and it still touches so much of the Islamic faith. If you can believe it, Hinduism, because there was so much commerce that happened. So grateful that I got to grow up with that level of mysticism, because it allows for magic and spirituality and unknown. And I really started to dive deeper into my spirituality, moving away from being religious, saying, this is a good context. This is how I grew up knowing how to pray. And so there's a level of comfort in knowing. It's like going back to your old neighborhood. Maybe some things changed, like maybe that deli closed, but you have the memory of it. That's what staying Orthodox feels like to me. I think intentionality is also a big part of my spiritual practice. How do you focus energy? What does that actually look like in your day-to-day practice? have an open heart, have an open mind, do well for yourself by doing well for others. So many of us have been ostracized, but spirituality, communion with our fellow person, we only have this body in this lifetime once. And so just connect with each other.
My name is Reverend Sister Mary Mae King, member of a mission house of the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence here in Chicago, the Second City Sisters, Abbey of the Irreverent Being. The Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence are an order of queer and trans nuns founded in 1979 to promulgate universal joy and expiate stigmatic guilt. There's orders all around the world and new orders forming all the time. We manifest in the community as fabulous drag nuns and guards, and we spread joy. We remind people that they are born perfect, that they should feel free to live their life, free from guilt and shame, with peace in their heart. We dress up the way that we do to give others space. If we can look like this, then you have the freedom to go out into the world being who you are, as you are. We might be out there educating, fundraising, participating in activism and protest. We hold ministries of presence, living at the intersection of protest and performance art, reminding the queer community, as long as they're not hurting anybody else, are free to explore themselves and their identity in any way that they see fit. The first sisters in San Francisco were modeled after 14th century Flemish nuns. And so we engage in what's called serious parody. We dress up in religious iconography, habits, flamboyant drag makeup. We're nuns, but totally queer and fabbed out. We're not emulating nuns. We are queer nuns, and we do the same work that nuns do. And sometimes it's a point of contention. We revere nuns of other faiths and other orders that do the hard work that we do. There are some people that don't enjoy engaging with us because even just the suggestion of religiosity, even though we are secular nuns, or the way that we look, even if it's serious, paradizing, it still is uncomfortable for some people because of the degree of religious trauma. And so if I come across someone who just doesn't want to engage, I totally respect that. It's not our place to push anything on anybody. We're a secular order of nuns too. So we accept all faiths and people of no faith. Many people in our community have experienced religious trauma, and we exist to be that safe space to explore the deeper questions in life, questions of identity and where we come from and how we practice our own personal moralities. I myself and several other members are ordained ministers. We can legally provide services as marriage officiants or hospital chaplains or funeral services and, you know, other traditionally religious needs. But we can serve those in a way that is secular and that feels safe for our community. One thing that most houses do is glitter blessings. Say a blessing and taking a little glitter on your thumb and putting it on someone's forehead. Recently, one of our sisters did an opening blessing at IML here in Chicago, International Mr. Leather. Queer people do still long for directed positive energy. Sometimes when we're shut out of religious spaces, we miss that communal feeling, directing positive energy towards something, towards a goal, towards strengthening our community. So it doesn't even have to be mystical. Whoever your diva is, whatever your deity is, even if it's just to yourself and that higher self that's inside of you, that you aspire to be the best version of yourself. And so we seek to, as we said, expiate stigmatic guilt, whether that's your age, your body, your race, whatever it may be, whatever stigma is attached to you that you may feel shame or guilt from, we seek to remove that and tell people, you know, it's okay. No, be yourself. Be who you are. You're beautiful.
My name is Ricky Hill. I use they, them pronouns. I identify as an anti-Zionist egalitarian Jew. There is a beautiful tradition of Jewish renewal, which is more earth-based and mystical. I came to it as an adult. I just really started to have just a lot of questions about religion, the world, and started to learn from people who had been deeply entrenched in Jewish life, in Jewish mysticism, like Kabbalah. Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb, one of the first generation of women rabbis, just an incredible, incredible human, and does a lot of Palestinian solidarity work. Different feminist ways of thinking about Judaism spoke to me in a way that I was like, oh, this makes so much sense. This is where I am meant to be. So there are different strands of Judaism. There's Orthodoxy, which is very, very strict and follows different halakhic Jewish law. Then there's conservative in terms of approach and interpretation. And then there's Reform. You have the same text, but you maybe approach it and interpret it differently. Something that's really beautiful about Judaism is that it is an ever-evolving faith. There are currently rabbis who are coming up with different sorts of Jewish rituals in terms of transgender folks, non-binary folks, being able to go through the same sorts of spiritual traditions and Jewish rituals that come up at different points in time in your faith. Really finding ways to be inclusive and say, this isn't something that you should be left out of. It's something that the leaders of these traditions need to be responsive to and need to figure out. Love the sinner, hate the sin. Doesn't make sense to me. Queer people practicing religion, I think it's about as real as you can get, because if you can find a way to be supported in something that everybody wants to tell you isn't for you, I feel like you've got it then. There's a group here in town called Sfara, a space for Talmudic learning, announced that the Transgender Talmud Project, I believe, their own organization that focuses solely on transgender people in Jewish life, a resource for congregations when there are rabbis who have trans and non-binary folks within their congregation. It's really powerful for me. Being Jewish and being queer makes so much sense because they are always in flux and are always changing. Both feed into my desire to just live in the liminal. In Judaism, the whole point is to ask questions. Or Hadash is one of the original organizations for queer Jews, really instrumental in laying the foundation for how I practice Judaism and how I think all queer Jewish folks practice Judaism, whether or not they know the name Orthodosh. In 2010, there was a cargo plane bomb plot by some Saudi terrorists, and Orthodosh was one of the named targets. Bringing religion and queerness together is viewed as radical, as a threat, something that you can't do. Groups like Orthodosh just prove that that's patently incorrect and wrong, and that people live very full spiritual lives. Groups like Orthodosh laying a lot of that groundwork to make it so that it's not even a question, so that there's not a struggle, so that people don't actually have to have a standalone congregation that they go to be affirmed, that it's like, I think you could go into most synagogues in the city of Chicago as a queer person and be affirmed.
My name is Maurice Rex Randall. My pronouns are he, him, his, all pronouns. I'm totally fine with all of them. I grew up Christian. I guess I would still say that I'm pretty Christian, but leaning more on the spiritual side of things. Definitely practice a little tarot, some hoodoo, borrow from my own cultures as well. Growing up, I wasn't always sure that I was queer or what that meant. I knew that I was different, but I also knew that I wanted to do good. I knew the right things to say. I would sit quietly in the church. I went to a big church, a mega church out in the suburbs. They were having their talent competition, and I'm a singer. I was really interested because I just wanted to be on stage. And my grandmother, she goes, well, you know you can't sing Britney Spears. And I was like, well, yeah, I know I can't sing Britney. And my 8-year-old mind went, you know what? this is not a place I want to share my artistry. So I never sang in church, ever. Which kind of came back to bite me. Ooh, child. When people would ask me to sing, I used to, and then I got one too many negative comments. In those moments, I wasn't protected enough. So I came up with this concept of like, oh, when people ask me, oh, are you going to sing? I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry. I don't do that for free. I went and got a degree in that, and that became my answer. That actually hurt me more than it hurt them. And now I would tell myself, like, you are actually more safe to express yourself than you think. And these are not harmful people. They just don't know you yet. My art and my Christianity felt in conflict. And through that is how I discovered like my queerness. I have a lot of great queer friends who are like, girl, I don't know why you're so clinging to this and the other. And I'm like, I can't blame them. I'm not gonna fight them. The church has done some horrible things. And the people in the church have done some horrible, horrible things, especially to queer people. I try not to push anything, but when they are really down, I pray that we can get through this together. Like, I certainly don't hide that I call upon Jesus all the time, but I'm not using Jesus in a weapon way. I still cling to this. It is the music that has kept me in the religion, with the knowledge that this book that has several different stories in it trying to mash into one are in direct conflict with each other. But the music, specifically like the big choir, the Mississippi Mass Choir, the Tri-City Singers, like these massive choirs that come together, pour their hearts into it. The performer in me can see that expression that like I'm throwing it all at the wall. I'm showing myself. I am bearing myself. At the end of the day, I've tried everything on my own. What is the harm in reaching out to this bigger spirit above me? And it makes sense why Black people cling to religion, because our ancestors were forced to learn this religion, but still they took the concepts and were able to move past their capturers, you know, the enslavement. The Bible was used to teach enslaved people, like, do not try to go against us. And how smart of my ancestors to go, actually, I think that the Bible is saying this, despite you taking out the pages and still clinging to that. I think that's amazing. It's still flawed. It's still a very flawed system. The Black church is intertwined with what's happening in day-to-day Black life. There's civil rights movement, feeding people, connecting with the Black Panthers. So many pivotal moments. The political sphere, people running for president come to their churches and talk, for better or for worse. Nothing, you know, nothing moves our Black creativity. And I think that's the same with Black religion or Black people's version of religion in the Christian sphere. I want to be very mindful that there are Black people who do not practice Christianity and their religion is valid or lack thereof is also valid. I really love my family and their connection to religion, even though sometimes I have an affront to it because of my own protection. I do realize that it is their way of connecting because it was the way that they were taught. Religion and spirituality can all be great if you are in a place of love. The idea that there is something greater than you means it lives outside of the human form and you can tap into that.
Yeah, yeah.
My name is Inga. My family is from Rwanda. I am a Lukumi Ifa Aberisha. Aberisha is Orisha devotee in Yoruba. It's a Yoruba practice, but I practice the path that was developed when the enslaved got to Cuba. Taino culture, Spanish, and Yoruba combined into one. And it's beautiful. I love it. I've been practicing for about 3 years. My temple, my elders, located in Logan Square, Temple Orisha Ile Ifa, Baba Victor and Ia Ifefe. The temple is an Ile. We are a part of a spiritual house. Our Baba and our Ia are our spiritual God, mother, and father. And everyone that is a part of it, God siblings. There's also no obligation to denounce whatever religion you practiced before. So you could be Catholic and be up in here. You could be Muslim. You could be anything and practice this, you know? And that's what I love about it, the freedom of it. I've decided to commit fully. But that's not how I grew up. Grew up Seventh-day Adventist until I had my spiritual awakening in 2020. COVID hit, churches shut down. Didn't have to go to church every Saturday the way my parents were making me. Started to develop my own relationship with God. Me and God, we were always locked in. I was like, I have a relationship with God. I know God. And I just feel like who y'all are saying he is not who he is. Especially being queer. The way it was presented to me, it was just very much, no, it's completely bad. It's completely wrong. And it's completely different from what I know now within Ifa. Ifa is very accepting of queerness. So it's a complete 180. And I love it for me, honestly. Slow and steady really does win the race in anything, but especially spirituality, because it's a lot of information. It's a lot of revelation, a lot of awakenings. And you don't want to overload yourself. Make sure you take the time before you follow anybody else, follow your gut. You know, there's elders. There's a lot of people with many different accolades and titles. If something doesn't feel right, it isn't. Okay. I would log on to YouTube, look up sermons by like specifically women, Black women, and just other people that I felt like, okay, I resonate with their stuff. After that, I was like, okay, God, like I need something to learn. I need some knowledge. I was scrolling through my TL one day and I saw something about Oshun, the Orisha of love and the river and creativity and fertility. And I started reading some more. I like this. And everything that I was reading, it didn't really feel like I was learning things. It felt like I was remembering. Certain things that I would observe in my home, my parents' spiritual gifts coming out, my dad using different herbs. Here, this will keep you safe from COVID. And I'm like, you're root working. Okay. My mom, things that she would say or do, I'm like, that's mediumship. But okay, you know, I'm just going to ignore it. When I started my spiritual journey into African traditions, I had an altar up in my parents' house, not paying rent, paying no type of bills, not my African parents' home. I was being bold. So it was very like frustrating. And for a while, I invalidated my parents' spiritual journey and their relationship with God. Because I was like, it's not the original. It's not like what we practiced before. So it's not valid to me. You know, I was very much still in my church hurt. And then I got humbled. I got humbled in a reading with my grandmother's spirit. She was like, look, you can be on this journey. We support it. Both of my grandfathers, well-known pastors back in Rwanda, me doing this and so publicly, it was a lot. It was a lot for the family. During the reading, she was like, you're very disrespectful to your parents' spirituality, and it's their prayers that have been protecting you this whole time. Just because they say amen and you say ashe doesn't make their relationship with God any less valid. Humbling. And then I had to think about it just on a historical standpoint. They couldn't control that. They had no choice. Colonization forced this on us. So it's like, how can I fault them for something that they had no part in, you know? And I was like, okay, you know what? I'm gonna put my altar down. I'm gonna respect my parents' home. But as soon as I move out, I'm doing my own things. For Rwandan people, when I go back there, you won't really see traces of the tradition or any type of spiritual practice pre-colonization. That definitely was intentional. Our spiritual systems are not only spiritual systems, they are also revolutionary systems. They're the things that we use to free ourselves from oppression. That's why there's been a complete wiping out of it, because they saw that's how we get free. And then using the Bible to condemn who we are, condemn our Blackness, condemn our traditions, our Africanness, honestly, because all the things that make us who we are, in a way, can be explained spiritually. You know, we have Orishas who manifest with homosexuality, with gender fluidity. Orisha Olokun, who is half man for half of the year and then woman for the other part of the year. If our deities can bend through different identities and orientations, why us, the ones who worship them, can't do the same? In our tradition, we believe in reincarnation, but we also believe it through your lineage. I might have been my great-great-great-grandmother. And I love that, you know, that we are able to return through the womb. Like once you die, you return through the womb. And it's very beautiful to me, that connection of ancestral reverence and birth and how that plays a part.
My name is Samer. I'm Palestinian. So in Arabic, my name is pronounced Samer. Pronouns anything with respect. I grew up traditionally Muslim, Sunni Muslim. And it was hard growing up, like coming from a family that immigrated to the United States and wanted to retain a Muslim identity. I had to go to religious school on the weekends, and it was traditionally like very, very masculine. There were a lot of things that I didn't understand. I didn't understand why I didn't fit in. So I struggled a lot with school, but really looking back, I was just like a non-binary, trans or gender fluid person who really struggled to be in all masculine spaces. I didn't connect with other boys my age. And I learned a lot of my religion from my mother. I always wanted my mom to teach me religion and spirituality, faith. My mom left her family back home in Palestine. So she had a lot on her plate. And the only avenue to teach her children faith by the textbook was, you know, these schools. And my relationship to Islam externally very early on was incredibly gendered. I remember there was this girl, I'd seen her throughout the years. We'd always play tag. Once I turned like 12 or 13, I remember her mom pulled her aside and pulled me aside. And they're like, you can't play together anymore. Like, he's a boy and you're a girl. Historically, Islam is not inherently homophobic or transphobic or misogynistic. These things that exist in our culture exist in all cultures, right? Like, we know that misogyny and homophobia was not always that way. Like, a couple hundred years ago, men and women prayed together. Yeah, I like remember from such a young age really struggling to reconcile with a faith that was separating people from me that I leaned on who were women or girls. It just becomes so intense because it's stated, but it's not explicit. And so you're just left so confused to interpret, to read into things as a child, to be like, did they tell her to stop playing with me? And I never saw her again after that. That's the other crazy thing. My experience being in a community that unfortunately has been like colonized and has experienced generational trauma has been that some of my relationships have been disappeared. And that was hard to reconcile because I didn't want to sacrifice my faith or my religion. My wife was a Muslim. I didn't want to give that up because I'm a Palestinian. And so to watch my home be taken away from me complicates what a home even is. And so I had to know from a very young age, well, people can take away your physical home, fascism, white supremacy, slavery, like all of these histories, right? So people have historically been losing their homes. But I was so young and I didn't understand this. But I think what really carried through is my mother's unyielding love for me. I think that seed that she planted in me ever since I was a baby, maybe ever since I was even a concept or a thought to her, that love transcends. So I always used to feel like I was privately Muslim. Like, I didn't feel like there was space for me to like really lead with faith in the queer community. My introduction to the community was party scene. And it's not like I was talking about Islam on the dance floor, even though now I'm learning the history of house music. Like, okay, this is church. For some people, Queen at Smart Bar, it's on Sunday. That's their church because maybe they can't go to church in the way that they want to go. I started interpreting it as like my mosque. I was like, you know what? Treat these people like you would treat anyone at a mosque. How would I treat anyone at a mosque? I would smile with love and respect. And that has helped me so much. In my adulthood, yeah, I still identify as a Muslim. There's ways now that I'm like blending my fashion Islamically as well. Like, I'm bringing in a lot of like Islamic. Can I show you something real quick?
Well, I went to Queen during Ramadan in one of my prayer rooms, this beautiful white halo. But around the waist, I have this coin belt. I had this coin belt, so I wrapped it around the waist in this like prayer outfit. I felt like I was praying into the speaker. I literally looked at the speaker, and I swear to God, that night at Queen, it was dancing with us. I just gave my hand to it, and I just like, thanked the speaker, and I felt like I was praying. Because I can't go to a mosque. I have my tattoos, I have my earrings. I've heard, you know, whispers here and there of like a queer friendly mosque. And eventually I'll make my way back in there. But I think my prayer looks different. It looks different now. I have to give my thanks to Black people in America because house music and soul music and electronic music, like that connection that I feel, that spirit that is in that room with me, is an extension of their community and their legacy and their history on this land. And I have nothing but gratitude to Black and brown people in this country. One of the most important lessons that Islam taught me is that nothing is forever and nothing is permanent. And I have held that in my heart, and it has gotten me through truly some of the darkest times. You are a blessing. I am a blessing. We are blessings. Keep going.
I'd like to thank each person who we heard from today for their vulnerability and their perspective, for their care and devotion. For our final sonic moments together, we'll return back to where we began. At Gerber Heart, where so many stories, personal liturgies, and relics are being preserved. And it's not just a container for history, it's also a living space. A space where the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence meet monthly.
My show, Midnight Sacrament, the Mary and Judas show, is Saturday night. It's a late night kinky queer church rave play for Jesus.
Oh my God.
And it's like an hour show about Mary and Judas, and then a DJ comes out and a disco ball, and it turns into a dance party in a church. And I would love for y'all to come. It's in Andersonville at Ebenezer Lutheran Auditorium.
A space that invites not only memory, but one that welcomes exploration. Somewhere safe to ask and research life's biggest questions. You'll hear from Sharon on how you can make the pilgrimage to Gerber Heart and explore the archives, both spiritual and secular.
If you want to do your own research at Gerber Heart, there are a couple of ways to go about it. The first step I would recommend is going to the website. There is a collection of what we call finding aids, which are basically an overview of each collection in Gerber Heart's compository that have been at least partially cataloged. So you can research through those, see what kind of objects or collections you're interested in viewing. If you don't see something that you're looking for, you can reach out through email, and someone at Gerber Heart will be happy to assist you find the boxes you need. Once you put in that request, either from the website or just a general request, you can come into Gerber Heart and we'll have a big cart of boxes for you to look at, and you can sit in the reading room, take your time, and go through all the documents.
And finally, Maurice.
Oh, baby, like a fool I went and stayed too long. Not a really dear to me. I can be a better man, but here I am. When you think I feel with you, baby, sign seals live, but I'm yours. Here I am, baby, sign seals live, but I'm yours.
This episode was produced by Hannah Vitti and edited by Bill Healy. Unboxing Queer History Season 2 is co-created by Aaron Bell and Jen Mintel. Special thanks to the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation for providing major funding for this season, and for the support of listeners like you. Learn more about how you can support the preservation of our collections and help us continue unboxing queer history. Visit gerberheart.org. Next time, join us as Anna Mason explores the 2024 Do Say Gay class from DePaul that met at Gerber Heart and asks why book bans and censorship continue to be relevant threats today.